Well, you always know it's the start of term because you're all here on time and you're relatively quiet, concentrated, all those new resolutions to take detailed notes. In about 6 months, you'll be late, coming in with beer and chatting avidly. But we've got you as a captive audience because you're still slightly intimidated by the wonderful LSE. So you've got a very special welcome to the first of our evening seminars in the Centre for the Study of Human Rights, evening talks. And a special welcome to those of you who are at the LSE for the first time in this academic year. It's one of the great treats in running a centre like the Centre for the Study of Human Rights is that you can kind of have some of the people whom you really admired and whose writings and presence in your subject you've enjoyed over many years. You can actually invite them to come, and there's a chance they will. If you write from your own home as yourself, inviting them to come for a drink, you invariably won't get any reply. But if you're the director for the Centre for the Study of Human Rights, for some reason they reply. I, of course, assume it's my personality. But in my entire life as a student of law, I've been dogged by the presence of Professor Brian Simpson. I just checked them because I could barely believe it, but he wrote, I thought, incomprehensible book on the history of land law, which for some equally incomprehensible reason, the professor who taught me land law in Dublin regarded as the definitive treatise. So from my first year, I've been studying Brian's work. And then he produced, as though remorseful of this first book, he produced a racy book about basically eating people, which was a tremendous success, Cannibalism and the Common Law. And then he went on to, I think, studies of law in historical and political context, which are absolutely, I think, the way we should approach the study of law. A fantastic book on internment during the Second World War, in the highest degree odious, a famous quote from Winston Churchill, and more recently, the excuse for the invitation, a remarkable book on the European Convention on Human Rights, called, I think at the time, somewhat optimistically, it was pre-various actions to secure human rights and the end of empire. And I invited Brian to come to the centre and to speak to us about the European Convention on Human Rights 50 years on. Brian is, apart from a prolific writer, also now primarily based in the United States. Charles F. and Edith J. Klein, Professor of Law at the University of Michigan Law School, a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and also, I think, a Fellow of the British Academy, but possibly not, but he's speaking there next week. So could you please give a very warm and enthusiastic welcome for Professor Brian Simpson.
Well, thank you, Connor, and thank you all for coming here. I'm basically a historian who got into law by a sort of historical accident, and I've always been fascinated by texts which sort of last from one world into another world, things like Magna Carta, the Sermon on the Mount. That doesn't have any protocols and so on, but it's still around and so forth, and there's something sort of fascinating about that. Now, the European Convention is already a celebrated text, and it's going to last as one. And it came into force on 3rd of September 1953, when there were 10 ratifications. It's quite entertaining to ask people who are studying human rights to name the 10 ratifications. They get 9 of them right, but they always miss the other, because it was the SAR, which no longer exists as an independent entity. And I first want to say a word or two about the world in which this convention was born. Europe was devastated. It had lived through the most appalling winter, 1947 winter, when the sea froze. And so I remember this. I'm terribly old. I can remember these things. You all can't, and so on. The cities in Europe were heaps of rubble. Caen was just a heap of rubble. German cities were just heaps of rubble. Some had escaped, like Paris and Bruges and so on. There were collapsed economies. The UK was virtually bankrupt. For all practical purposes, was bankrupt. There was recent memory of the horrors of defeat and occupation. People in France had only just got through the period of the post-war lynchings of collaborators and so forth. Nobody knows how many people were lynched, but they could all remember not only the horrors of occupation by foreign troops, but the appalling things which were done to the French by the French, by their own people. They could remember that. The composition of Europe, of the Western European Democratic Club, was different. Germany was divided, and under the western parts was under military rule, as was the eastern part. Spain was outside the club. It was under General Franco. Portugal was outside the Democratic Club. European countries retained huge empires. Some 60 million people lived in the British Empire at that time. France had a huge empire. Denmark, a pretty mini one. The Netherlands had lost most of theirs, but some of it was still left, and so on. There were huge empires still left. There was profound fear in Western Europe. There were people in France who'd been invaded in 1870, 1914, and again in 1940. They'd been there three times. One monster, fascism, appeared to be down, but not totally down. There was still Franco Spain, for example. Another monster, Stalinist communism, was doing very nicely, thank you very much. There was severe military weakness and great fear of Russia. I remember in those days, when I was a student, we had to be in the army, and I was in the 15th Regiment of Foot, which was the regiment which was marched up to the top of the hill and marched down again, and it was very like that. And we were conducting an exercise one night using live ammunition on the Fylingdales area in Yorkshire, and a young man called Brian Newton put the machine guns by a map reading error on the wrong side of the road. So a young man who was driving back after some illicit gathering up with his girlfriend in the middle of the night was suddenly submerged in a hail of tracer fire and came running down the road screaming, "The Russians have landed, the Russians have landed." And he really thought they had. And we thought, oh my God, questions in Parliament, courts martial, and so we filled him up with whiskey, and he eventually enjoyed a nice evening with us. In Western Europe, Italy might well, by election, become a communist state. West Germany, well, we didn't know about that. France could have done. There was deep fear in France of a revived Germany. And on top of this, the Cold War had broken out. In 1947, the negotiations to settle the future of Germany collapsed. And so the idea developed of developing some sort of Western club, Western bloc, to provide some sort of combat to Soviet power and to establish some sort of independence from the two major powers of the time, both the USA and the Soviet Union. And that's the world in which the European Convention was born. And it all goes back to a famous speech by the British Foreign Secretary, Ernie Bevin, Uncle Ernie as he was called, in January 1948, who, recognizing that relations with the Soviet Union had collapsed, said that what we needed was a spiritual union of Western Europe. It's not clear what he meant quite, but it was something spiritual, it was something like a union. There was also a very strong European federalist movement. Lots of people who, especially from continental Europe, not from Britain, believed that the solution to the horrors of Europe, and just consider the horrors of Europe, the Holocaust. I mean, that's Europe, you know, the home of civilization, the home of the Holocaust. That the solution to these horrors of Western Europe was some sort of federation. And they held a big conference in The Hague in 1948, and they called for a parliamentary assembly and a charter of human rights. And that ultimately led to the establishment of the Council of Europe in 1949. And in the statute which established this, it said the Council of Europe, which was an expression of this idea of some sort of union, was dedicated to the maintenance and further realization of human rights and fundamental freedoms. Now, what were they really worried about? Freedom democracy had just been and was being re-established in this small Western European club. And what they wanted was some sort of ideological statement and some sort of mechanism which could protect the recently reacquired freedom and liberty from erosion in the future. And there were great clashes as about what form this Charter of Rights should take. But the European Federalists were very keen on the idea of a juridical protection, that rights should be protected by some supranational body, which was a court, which gave judgments, like a court, binding judgments. Other people said, no, the protection of human rights has to be achieved through political mechanisms rather than that. And another clash at the time was whether, if we had some sort of charter, this charter should simply very clearly specify what the rights were and the limitations from them. And there were other people coming from the continental legal tradition who said, no, what we need is a rather loosely drafted charter, and we will then develop through our court and our juridical mechanisms a jurisprudence of human rights. We'll do it by case by case, like the common law. We'll develop in the light of experience a jurisprudence of human rights. And that's the world in which it was born. Now, how has Europe changed since then? First of all, there's been dramatic economic recovery in Western Europe. I mean, really dramatic. Secondly, Europe has become accessible. When I was young, you could get hardly any money to travel to Europe. I knew a philosopher in Oxford who annually wrote a pornographic novel, which he could then deliver to the back door of the Olympia Press in Paris, where they paid you in used banknotes, and he could then take his family on the continental holiday. I myself inquired, at the time American Grave Commission was digging up dead Americans to take them back to America and bury them there. Americans, this practice of taking their dead home, the British leave their dead abroad. It's a curious cultural difference. And I'd heard you could get good money in dollars for digging up dead Americans. And we all thought, well, you know, it'd be a bit rough, but it'd be worth it. And we wrote off and they said, sorry, we've dug up plenty and we don't need your services. So since then, Europe has become accessible. Every football hooligan can go to Europe now. There's no problems about travel. Then there's the end of empire. Well, is there the end of empires? The end of formal empire? No, what about Iraq and Kosovo and so on? One sort of wonders whether empire isn't still going on under different sorts of names. Then the Western European club has changed. Spain and Portugal have come in from the cold. Germany eventually ends up reunited. Then there's been the European Union. Now, at the time when the convention was entered into, was signed in 1950 and came into force, that was all sort of very embryonic. It all started with the Schuman plan. Robert Schuman made a statement in May 1950, and that led to the beginnings of the European Union today, with the six forming the European Coal and Steel Community. And just sort of think of what was that about? What was the idea of putting supranational control over coal and steel? It was to stop war. It was to stop war. People were very frightened of war. Then there's been the end of the Cold War and the collapse of communism as a system of government, and also at the same time, of course, the collapse of powerful communist parties in Western Europe. There never was a strong communist party in Britain. There was a significant communist party and entertaining moles and so on, but it never amounted to anything very much. The British are such apathetes, they can't get excited about anything. But in Europe, there were strong communist parties, very vigorous communist parties, but they sort of had largely disappeared. And there's been the collapse of fascism, or has there? Fascism, I always think, is a little bit like shingles and whatever that disease is, chicken pox. You know, if you get chicken pox, which you all used to get when you were a kid, you get spots and you scratch and you get better after a bit. But the old chicken pox virus is very clever. It hides in your nervous system and just sits around there for 10, 20, 30 years. It can wait, and out it comes and gives you a nasty disease called shingles. And I think, you know, you want to worry a little bit about that. There are nasty little things under flat, wet stones in Europe at the present time. So I wouldn't be too sort of sure that that's all gone away. Now, what about the convention? Well, of course, it's changed in many respects. I've got the revised version after protocol number 11 sitting here and so on. It's changed through protocols, but it's changed in other ways which are nothing to do with protocols. Protocols are a way of amending the thing or adding to it. And the first protocol, by the way, was simply part of the convention, which they had difficulty negotiating. It's really part of the original convention. The first thing that people know about it and use it. Now, that wasn't always so. I studied law in Oxford from 1951 to 1954. The Oxford Law Faculty then was an extremely dim institution. But it had some quite bright people in it, and, you know, there was me, for example. It wasn't too bad. But I never remember hearing the European Convention mentioned when I was a student in Oxford. Not once. International law was taught to my group of people by a lovely man called Robert Houston, who once told me, there are only 5 discussable issues in international law, so it's only necessary for undergraduates to come for 5 tutorials, and certainly the European Convention wasn't one of them. This is for all sorts of reasons. A lot of it is the activities of NGOs. One NGO which I do a teeny-weeny bit of work with, the Air Centre, for example, has done a great deal to spread knowledge of the European Convention. This centre does it too. And of course, with the incorporation of the Convention into domestic law, lawyers all now have begun to know about it. My youngest daughter's a junior doctor in the hospital, and when she's working on casualty, she has, you know, vomit thrown at her, furniture thrown at her by drunks off the street, and human rights. People say, you're violating my human rights. And she said, no, I'm giving you an injection. It does hurt a little bit, but it's not a violation of article, whatever it is. So it's become known about and used. It's become universal in Western Europe. France took an awful long time to sign up, not till 1974, and it didn't accept individual petition till 1981. Spain and Portugal have come in, so the Western European club has become universally governed by this. The right of individual petition and the acceptance of the jurisdiction of the court was originally optional because you couldn't get all the countries who were prepared to sign the thing to agree to that. They said, no, we can't have individual petition. The British opposition came, guess from where? From the colonial office, because they didn't want people out in the colonies getting sort of uppity ideas about appealing to some supranational body if they had been ill-treated or ill-used. And so it took a long time for that to become universal. But eventually, everybody has signed up to this and has to sign up to it. There's nobody out of it. You cannot imagine the controversy which centered about the right of individual petition in the discussions which led to the European Convention and earlier to the United Nations conventions. People viewed it with deep alarm. But of course it doesn't make any sense to have individual human rights if individuals can't do anything about their violation. It's just sort of crazy. But you can imagine that in government people realized, and they were dead right, that a right of individual petition is going to be trouble to governments. And it is trouble to governments, because the whole underlying ethos of the convention is you cannot ultimately always trust governments. That's what it's all about. So there's that. Then there's the extension of the convention to a huge number of countries now. I always forget exactly what it is, and I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, but I think the figure is now 44, but it may be that one of them hasn't ratified, but it's a lot. In terms of people, the convention now, in theory at least, protects about 770, 780 million people. That's a huge number of people.
It's even been extended, and one wonders whether this wasn't done in a bit of a fit of absence of mind, to the Russian Federation, which does not appear for the present to be paying a blind bit of attention to it, but perhaps it will. You know, these things take time, and so on. It's become linked to the European Union. If you want to get into the European Union, that's where the money is. If you want to get your snout into the trough, then you have to, first of all, clean up your Human Rights Act and sign up to the European Convention. It's come used as a ticket of entry. And, of course, the European Court now applies human rights law, and, you know, the European Union is getting into this act. None of these things have happened through protocols. Let me mention another. The mode of interpretation was dramatically altered by the famous case of Tyra. Tyra was one of those flagellant cases. The Britain was the last great home of the Western flagellant tradition. I know about that. I went to an English private school, and I know all about that stuff, and so on. And a great deal of enjoyment was given to some of our teachers, and so forth. Anyway, a young man called Tyra was going to be birched. That's a very nasty thing to do to somebody, very humiliating, very painful, for an offence of violence in the Isle of Man. And a case was brought under the convention. And the issue really was this. It never occurred to anybody when the convention was signed and came into force that it had anything to do with the abolition of corporal punishment in Western Europe. It's perfectly true. Corporal punishment was already on the way out in Western Europe. Britain, and particularly Scotland, were last homes of it, and the Isle of Man in particular. And the court decided that it would apply a form of interpretation which treated the convention as a living instrument. It didn't say, what did these guys or girls mean when it was signed up? But how should it be interpreted today in the light of changing and evolving patterns of understanding about human dignity and human and individual rights? And that was a critical decision, because it turned the convention from a intention of the founders type document into an evolving instrument for human rights protection. I've been in the Isle of Man teaching human rights with Caterina sitting up there, and as we first went there, we went about saying, don't mention Tyra, and so on. But actually, it's okay. Nobody wants to go back to this in the Isle of Man as they did when this case came up in the 70s and so on. Things have moved on. There's no embarrassment about it now. So that's a change. That means there's been a change in the function of the convention. The function originally was to protect existing liberty. It was conservative. Now it's become dynamic. It's a convention to be the basis for the dynamic further realization of human rights and fundamental freedoms. And that's particularly important with its extension to Central and Eastern Europe, where it's an instrument which can be used to assist those countries and the people in them who are trying very hard to establish decent democratic systems governed by the rule of law in which individual rights are protected. Now, originally, it was believed that the convention would be rarely needed. It would hardly ever be needed. And so there was the provisions which have now gone on the 11th Protocol for a friendly settlement. It was felt that most little bickers about human rights could be settled amicably without litigation, without going to the court and so forth. And there would be a very small caseload. And for many years, that was in fact what happened. But that's all changed, partly through evolutive interpretation, through, if you like, moving the goalposts, partly through NGOs and lawyers learning about the convention and using it, and also for another reason, I think those who originally were involved in the negotiation essentially did not understand, since they all came from upper middle class circles and so forth, they didn't understand quite how grotty life was for people at the bottom of the heap even in countries like England, which were supposed to be places where human rights and fundamental freedom were really protected. I wish I could, I mean to check this up, but about 1949, it was a bit before I was a student, there was a case of an insane police officer in Sheffield, and there was a special inquiry into his ill treatment of suspects, and he was sacked, and I was then sent off to some asylum with people in white coats looking after him. What's very interesting about the report on the case was that it was in the late 40s, the routine practice of detectives in Sheffield to beat housekeepers with whips. It was what normally went on. Wasn't some aberration, it was the normal thing. They didn't do it to people with upper middle class accents wearing suits. And I think there was a lack of awareness when the convention was entered into by people. For example, the Home Office never opposed the convention. It said, no, we don't mind, we haven't got any skeletons in our cupboards. Actually, there were some skeletons down there. And they've come out in some of the litigation. Now, present problems in the future. Well, the colonies have all gone, or for virtually have gone. Britain still has one or two places which either nobody else wants, like Tristan da Cunha, or places which, for one reason or another, it's difficult to get rid of, or, you know, there's opposition to it. You know, the government tried to get rid, you know, Tristan da Cunha, a little island in the middle of the South Atlantic. It blew up some years ago. The inhabitants were evacuated, accommodated in suitably disagreeable accommodation in England. Government thing, thank God we've got rid of Tristan da Cunha. They said, we can't stand the bright lights, we want to go home. And the British public rose in revolution and said, home they're going, and back they are there, and so on. And they live there to this day, hating the anthropologists who regularly visit them. And they actually ignore the anthropologists, they walk through them. If you're an anthropologist, just trampled in Tristan. They hate them. And they also have the highest per capita consumption of aspirin which has ever been known. I don't know what the explanation of that is. But, you know, has colonialism actually gone? We have problems about the territorial reach of the convention, the famous Bankovich case, Kosovo, Iraq. Does the convention apply in Iraq? To the bit of Iraq which is either under or supposed to be under British control. I say supposed to be because it's not totally clear it is under British control. There are problems there. A second sort of problem lurking out there is emergencies. The convention's provisions on emergencies have never been very satisfactory in the way they've worked, and the Strasbourg institutions have, in my view, always rather leant over backwards to back the authorities in dealing with emergencies, insurrections, what people call terrorist movements and that sort of thing. Well, we're now moving into an appalling era of sort of permanent emergency, we are told. We have now got detention, indefinite executive detention without trial in this country, in what I think is peacetime, but we keep beyond being told is wartime. Well, it isn't wartime, it's peacetime. We gave that up the minute the Second World War ended. I mean, of course, the security people wanted to continue executive detention in 1945, but the government of the day wouldn't have it. They said, no, they all come out. So there's a real problem lurking out there. Then there's an acute problem about scale and caseload. The convention has now been extended to all these millions of people. And there is a growing, and it's going to grow further, caseload. And so there are great anxieties about what to do about this. Well, obviously, some of the anxieties can be solved by spending some more money. You beef up the secretariat and things like that. But there are proposals to deal with this problem of the caseload, which is very acute, I mean, there's no doubt about that, by toughening up the provisions as to when a individual petition case is admissible. not toughening them up very much, but toughening up a little bit. Now, that is the beginnings of the erosion of the right of individual petition, and it's a very worrying possibility. I'm not suggesting that the current proposals go dramatically far, but one wonders what's coming next, because this caseload problem is going to go up and up. In fact, the major work the Secretariat has to handle is with petitions which are, in fact, inadmissible. And the vast majority of petitions, which is applications to go to Strasbourg, are inadmissible. But still, there's a real problem there. And various ideas have been presented as to how to deal with this problem. For example, one proposal is to set up regional institutions. But the problem about that is you then lose the sort of unity of Europe under the convention. So there's a real problem there, and it's a thing that people are going to have to think about, I think, a great deal. I don't think the problem is going to go away. I mean, I think it's going to be an ongoing problem. It reminds me a little bit of when the health service was founded. When the health service was founded in Britain, it was the belief that if you gave people good medical care, the costs of medical care would decrease. But that isn't what happened for various reasons. One is, if you give people better medical care, they live longer and they get to be like me. I never go near a doctor. They don't find out some damn thing wrong with me and they want to give me more tablets and so forth. So there's that sort of problem. And there's also the problem, which is rather like the evolutive development of the European Convention, that medical science does not stay still. And many things which, when I was young, you just had to grin and bear and die and so on, now can be treated. There is a sort of a problem there. Now, it's not a problem to feel it's awful about, because it's good that this happens. It's good that this happens. But it is a problem, and it requires resources and thought. The one line which I think there's a lot in is that one needs much more, perhaps, in the way of efforts to try to get, especially countries which, you know, coming in from the cold and so forth, to help them get their acts together and improve human rights protection in the member states so as to reduce the call for interference by Strasbourg. Now, quite a lot of work of that sort has been done. I mean, new countries, there are vettings and checkings up on their laws and so forth. There are attempts to assist them, educational programs, and so forth and so on. There's a lot can be done in the way of getting out there and adopting a sort of proactive attitude towards local protection of human rights, rather than just sort of sitting back waiting for these cases to come to Strasbourg. I myself wonder whether the juridical model of the convention is necessarily always appropriate for dealing with these problems. You see, the juridical idea is you have a most of the cases are individual petitions, and the state cases hardly ever happen. You get individual petitions. It's like litigation inter partes. You bring a case against the government, and if you don't win, you take it up to Strasbourg, and you eventually, if you're lucky, get a judgment in your favour. It may be that mechanisms for administrative directions and so on from Strasbourg might be a way of developing a more proactive attitude to the problems. This is particularly so when you deal with endemic problems, and I just want to say a word about that. Some people think that protection of human rights is sort of cheap. It doesn't cost any money not to torture people. Well, actually, it does cost money not to torture people in two ways. You've got to catch the people who go in for torturing, and they can be very ingenious, and that can involve expenditure and checking and so forth. They don't torture people when, you know, the government, the anti-torture person is around, so it costs money. But it costs money in another way, that if you're not torturing people and you want to run a criminal justice system, then you have to do a bit of detection, and you have to have forensic laboratories and so on. It's more expensive than, as Fitzjames Stevens said in the 19th century, rubbing pepper into a suspect's eyes. It's more expensive. It requires training courses and so on. Now, there are some areas in which it's perfectly obvious that human rights protection requires economic resources. Two are quite simple. Fair trials.
How can you have fair trials if the judiciary are paid so little that they are under persistent pressure just to keep their families going, to take bribes and so forth? It's very, very difficult. How can you clean up the prisons? And prisons are a bit of a scandal throughout Europe, and don't let's sort of, you know, forget that our prisons are nothing to write home about. That you can't get better prisons. If you're going to have prisons, it takes a lot of money to run decent prisons. A lot of money. Prisons are more expensive to run than smart hotels if they're going to be run well. And so there is a real problem there about protection of human rights, because I've said that there's been this enormous economic improvement in Western Europe. I mean, Western Europeans are rich beyond the dreams of average compared to what they were in 1950, but that is not true, yes, in, for example, Albania, a country I've visited sometimes, where people are very, very poor and there's not a lot of money and so on to do things. So there's a real problem there, and it may be that you've got to think of human rights protection in conjunction with schemes for educational, economic assistance, training assistance, and so forth. And a lot of this work is being done at present, and that's a very sort of hopeful thing. So that's going to be a problem in the future. I wonder if there are other things which could be done within the convention which might help. Where you get systemic violations of human rights, for example, Italy has been a sort of a scandal for delay in trials and so forth for a long time. It could be that heavier awards by the European Court could be a mechanism which would encourage compliance, because it is, for many countries, much cheaper to pay up the awards issued by the Strasbourg Court than it is to do anything about the underlying problem. I mean, there is a possibility there of economic sanctions, but the problem about that is if you impose swingeing economic sanctions on very poor countries, that doesn't obviously improve the prisons. I mean, it presents a sort of problem. So I think that's going to be a problem in the future, which you're going to have to think about if you're studying human rights. At the end of the day, to date, the European Convention has been a pretty good success story. It's not a complete success story. It's already got such delays in its own mechanisms for adjudication, it's becoming something of a scandal. It's not a total success when lots of the documents and so forth which people need to use to protect human rights are not available in the local language. I mean, the languages of the court and so still remain French and English. Of course, the secretaries have people who know other languages and so forth, but the publication of material and so forth. There are problems about its handling of emergency powers. I think it hasn't been entirely successful there. There are a variety of problems, and we don't quite know whether the cohesion of the court will be adversely affected by the enormous extension of its jurisdiction. It's always vaguely assumed that if we extend Western European things to Central and Eastern Europe, the traffic of ideas will entirely be from Western Europe to Central and Eastern Europe. That's a really rather a colonialist sort of attitude, because the traffic of ideas may develop and go both ways, and that may be a good thing in the future, and it's something we'll have to watch out for it happening. Now, I've talked enough, and I'm beginning to cough, so I'm going to stop now and answer any questions I can.
Thank you, Brian, very much for that overview of the convention. Now, one of the features of our evening talks here at the LSE is our question and answer session. And what I'd like to do is encourage you all to consider making interventions, and especially people who are visiting from outside the LSE feel also that you can contribute to this. We have some roving mics at the top as well. And what I'd like you to do, please, is if you want to make an observation, that's fine. If you want to ask a question, that's also fine. If you want to do both, fine. But please firstly say who you are, or I might interrupt you. And if you're from an organization, for example, say that, because that's often interesting for people. And if you prefer not to give your name, that's fine. But we'd prefer if you could. And keep your remarks fairly succinct, if you would, please. And I might take two or three, Brian, and then perhaps you can deal with them in a row. Does anybody want to inaugurate the question and answer sessions at the LSE? We have one gentleman at the back there. Sir.
Okay. Tufail Chowdhury from Durham University. I was wondering whether you could think of a case under the convention where you think the individual petitioner shouldn't have won, where the court has won, because there's the sense in which the court is very conservative in its attitudes towards the state. But is there a situation where you think that the court went too far and gave in favour of the individual petitioner where it shouldn't have?
Thank you. That's an interesting question. Greatest hits, greatest failures of the convention. Do we have any other questions or observations? Sir, at the centre here. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Abhishek. I'm doing an LLM here. I wanted to know if you think that there's a danger in bringing rights home, like there has been in the Human Rights Act, whereby domestic courts are more likely to look at things like cost than you would on supranational level, and whether that would undermine the convention rather than actually bringing rights home.
Thank you very much. Do we have any other takers maybe from up here? Shall we go to Brian now? Just looking up, we have another gentleman. Gender skewed, so ladies, you're going to have to form the next session, I think, questions. Sir.
Chris Brown, LSE. You mentioned a lot of social changes, but one I don't think you did mention was the large number of immigrants who have come into Europe and over the last 50 years and who've generated, I think, quite a lot of caseload, various issues. Could you comment on that a bit?
Thank you. I've seen a number of hands up. I'm going to take Professor Simpson now, and then certainly this gentleman here, and then perhaps... good, okay, you too. But we'll take Brian on this now. Brian.
You asked me whether I could think of a case where it's gone too far in the protection of... off the top of my head, no, I can't think of such a case. One where I think it didn't go far enough was the Gibraltar shooting case. That was the case where the British Special Air Service, three soldiers, killed people in Gibraltar who were undoubtedly there doing a reconnaissance to plant a bomb, which would have, if it had worked, you know, would have possibly killed lots of people and so forth. People who were the members of the IRA who were there and so on were all killed, and their families brought proceedings. And the court in Strasbourg was very nervous of this case, and I was in the court when it gave its opinion, and it found against, by a majority, it found against the British government, but only on the ground that the planning of the operation had not adequately attended to the positive duty to respect human life. But they then said this, because these people who'd been killed by the Special Air Service were up to no good, which, I mean, there's never doubted that they were up to no good, that they thought there was no ground on which any form of compensation should be given to the families. I just find that extremely odd. It seems to me that once you've found there's been a violation of rights, and once, you know, in this case, it's quite clear that some people have suffered as a result of this, seems to be wrong that no award of compensation should be made. It involves some sort of idea of sort of transmitted guilt to the families. Now, I don't know about these families. I don't know whether they were or were not privy to what these people were doing in Gibraltar, but there was certainly no evidence before the court that they were privy to it. And that struck me as sort of showing a slightly sort of chicken-like attitude, because the court, of course, was aware that it was dealing with a very hot political issue, and it didn't want to get across too much with the British government. And there was outrage in the British press about the finding, though it seems to me that the court leant over backwards in the case to be as sympathetic to the British authorities as they possibly could. So I wasn't very happy about that case. Now, the danger of bringing rights home, of undermining the convention. I'm not absolutely clear what the drift of this question is, but it may be something like this, that now that rights have been brought home, and granted the fact you have to exhaust domestic remedies before you can go to Strasbourg, it could arguably make it more difficult to get your rights vindicated because of the cost of domestic litigation.
I mean, the trouble about litigation in the courts is that if you're, you know, up on a criminal charge or something, you get legal aid, you get legal representation and so forth. But civil litigation is extremely expensive. And broadly speaking, only the very poor and the very rich can engage in it. I personally do not know a single person who has ever engaged in civil litigation in this country. I don't personally know such a person. I mean, in the sense that they're not amongst my body of friends and so on, friends and acquaintances. And so if we're now going to say, well, you know, you can't really win in Strasbourg because these points have all been ventilated or can be ventilated domestically and you have to exhaust domestic remedies, that could, I suppose, make it more difficult to get your rights vindicated in Strasbourg than is at present the case. The other thing about bringing rights home, the idea when this was done was that, one of the government's arguments was that if you brought rights home, recourse to Strasbourg would be less necessary, would be less frequent. That doesn't seem to me to be happening or to be likely to happen, because one of the effects of bringing rights home was that all sorts of lawyers who previously wouldn't have known which way up to hold the convention now know about it. And so just as people in casualty say, ouch, you're violating my human rights, there's wide dissemination of knowledge of this. And so it may be that the initial effect of this may be to put up a course to Strasbourg. The whole thing is a sort of problem. I mean, the convention is a problem about being injured or wounded by its own success. I mean, it's like the health service. I mean, the health service problems are mainly the products of its own success. And that's a real difficult issue. I mean, it's not some issue to which there's some simple solution. I mean, if you let everybody, you know, die as babies, they don't clutter up hospitals when they're 70. I mean, it's quite simple. And so, you know, the relative success of the health service, and of course of all sorts of other things like the internet and widespread knowledge about medical practice and all sorts of other things, in a sense, is the threat to a socialized system of medicine. And it's a bit like that with human rights. I think this is the sort of problem which, if you're studying this subject, you want to think about and address, because I don't think any clear answers have yet emerged. The proposals currently going on will paper over the cracks for a few years, but they're not radical enough to solve the problem in the long term, as far as I can see. Now, the other question is immigrants. Now, two things about that. The first thing, the convention does not contain a freestanding anti-discrimination provision. It has a provision which says you mustn't discriminate in relation to the convention rights. The other thing is that when the convention was entered into, you see, pre-war, there were systems of minority protection in newly formed states, for example, countries like Poland and so forth. These systems of minority protection were bitterly resented by these countries, and they were not very effective, but they were run under the League of Nations. And some of these minority protection schemes, the one in a place called Upper Silesia, was actually relatively effective pre-war. It was the only relatively effective provision. Now, an awful lot of human rights problems are about the persecution of minorities. They just are. If you just think about the worst cases you've heard, Rwanda and so on, they're about the persecution of minorities. You know, in Western Europe, there is quite a head of steam. You've only got to read the popular press in Britain. The anti-immigrant, lobby is quite strong and so forth. This is a serious sort of problem. And it can be addressed to some degree under the convention, but not all the problems can be addressed under it. Furthermore, there are parts of Europe where there is absolutely endemic persecution. And it's not absolutely clear that the juridical model of individual litigation is adequate to deal with it. I'm thinking of the persecution of the Roma in some parts of Europe. The pre-war minority protection systems were very ineffective, but they caused a lot of political brouhaha and so forth. And the people responsible for international affairs after the war, both in the United Nations and in Europe, were absolutely adamantly hostile to any form of minority protection being built into either the European Convention or the United Nations Conventions. The hostility to it was extreme. Mrs. Roosevelt, for example, solemnly said in public in the United Nations, there are no minorities in America. And that was the official view, just as the French official view has always been, France just has the French. There's no such thing as minorities in France. They don't exist. And the sort of denial of this problem was a powerful force at the time when the convention was entered into in governmental circles. And we know that, you know, all the problems in Northern Ireland are about competing groups and minorities and so forth. It's all over the place.
Thanks, Doug. We have certainly got this gentleman, a lady, and a lady here, and we'll take you three. Sir. Remembering to give
Hi,
your name.
Hi, Michael Harden with Legal Action Against War. You mentioned whether or not we're responsible for human rights in Iraq, and I would be very interested to see if you had a view on whether there's a joint liability and somebody who had been bombed upon could go to the European Court against us, whether it's an American bomb or our bomb. And then with the figures and the vast caseload that it seems to be generating, that if you go into a law library and look at the Act, the edges of the page are totally black, whereas any other law going back for yonks has hardly been looked at. It's very, very interesting to people. It seems to take about 30,000 cases a year. You have a 1-3% chance of getting a judgment in favour and about 5% chance of the case even being looked at. So lots and lots of cases are coming and failing. And they seem to have developed lots of technical rules that are very difficult to get at. And maybe if they could codify what they've done so far, it would help people not bring cases that are going to fail before they start.
Thank you. We will have a chance at drinks afterwards to develop some of these points. I know a lot of hands are up. There was a lady at the centre. Yes, madam. She caught my eye earlier.
Thank you. Hi. Can you hear me? Yes. My name is Christine Cody. I'm a solicitor and I do immigration, refugee, human rights law.
The idea of having a sort of whatever you call it, an Attorney General's department, a department, a Strasbourg institution with a secretariat and lawyers whose job it was to intervene in cases, to take proceedings when nobody else would take them, where individuals weren't able to, which would have considerable resources to bring such cases, something like a public prosecutor's office. Now, there are great difficulties with that suggestion. How could you make sure that this body was relatively dispassionate, wasn't, you know, under the thumb of particular governments? It would be a tricky thing to set up. But there might be some room for some institution of that sort, because relying on interstate cases to deal with major problems hasn't happened much. I mean, the number of interstate cases brought is very, very small, and the only sort of really dramatic ones were Greece against the United Kingdom over Cyprus, and that was politically motivated, there's no doubt about that at all, but it was, you know, the Greeks had a lot of good points on their side. And the other one is the proceedings against Greece under the colonels, which led to Greece actually withdrawing from the convention. But some sort of centralized body with a general, a commission or something with a general power to intervene or to take cases on in the name of the states of the Council of Europe might be a mechanism, might be an administrative mechanism which would be better than the existing, hardly ever used, interstate procedures. Of course, the advantage of states being it, states have lots of money. So you'd need to fund such a body so that you could carry out the necessary investigations and so forth.
Thanks, Brian. There's one person who's enthusiastically seeking to ask a question, which is great. I think we're coming to the point where we're beginning to wind up the event. There might be one or two other people who really would like to ask a question. Remember, there's drinks afterwards, so we can carry on informally. carry on talking, that is, not drinking. Yes, madam, there you are. It's coming from your right.
Teresa Steen, I'm a student at LSE and also work as a lawyer for the Norwegian Attorney General. And I was wondering if you would comment on if you're worried about the fact that at least in Western Europe, we see in Norway and I think also in the UK, that the human rights are being exploited in a way by the rich people, the people with lawyers, big companies. We have big cases in Norway not involving prisoners or immigrants or minorities, but more financial aspects of the human rights, and that the human rights by that might lose some of its respect being misused.
Yes, thank you, Frank. We'll just take one more, if I may. Final question at the top, and then we'll wind up with your observation. Sorry, Brian.
Francesca Clark from the Centre for the Study of Human Rights here at LSE. Professor Simpson, I really enjoyed your talk, but I don't think you said an awful lot about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was, of course, drafted a couple of years before the convention and is referred to in the preamble as an inspiration for it, and many of its rights are enumerated in the convention. Of course, it was drafted by a wider group of people than just Western Europeans. And I wonder if you think that the European Convention would ever have been drafted without the Universal Declaration, and what exactly the inspiration it did draw from it.
On the potential for abuse, yes, I think that there is a problem there. I mean, once the human rights were brought home in this country, you got the impression that the vultures were gathering and so on. And that the respectability, as it were, the legitimacy of human rights protection could be affected. One very odd thing is the possibility of artificial persons, of companies, taking proceedings under the convention. Now, I've been asked by a friend of mine to find out, and I've yet not done it, how that got into the system, because it is very odd. And so I think there is a risk there. And of course, the human rights, you know, for example, protection of right of property and so on, can be used by the well-heeled and the rich and so on. Because the flip side of that is if you really believe in human rights, well, everybody has them. You know, awful people, rich people, fat cats, you know, miserable cats. Most people, I think, out in the street there worry more about villains having human rights. I've had people say, why do these bastards have human rights? I say, because they're bastards, and bastards are human beings. That's the rule of the game, and so on. So I think there is a problem there. The Universal Declaration, yes, the Universal Declaration was, as it were, the first step, and then the United Nations started trying to draft covenants and ran into intense difficulties over that. And of course, what happened to the United Kingdom was that they got sort of fed up with the discussions of the United Nations and thought, well, perhaps we can join a smaller club, the European club, and get somewhere there. I think the Universal Declaration was a sort of foundation charter for the whole movement. It was variously regarded at the time. At present, it tends to be viewed as the great step forward. At the time, the leading human rights lawyer in this country, Hirsch Lauterpacht, viewed it with absolute contempt. And he viewed it with contempt because he said, this thing is a lot of pious statements and so on, but there's no enforcement mechanism whatsoever. And it is pathetic, he thought, that the countries of the world, after the horrible things that had recently happened, that the best they can do is get together and sign up to a document which doesn't impose any legal obligations on anybody at all. Now, in retrospect, perhaps he was wrong, because it was part of a process, and eventually the UN did get its conventions, and they have had some effect and so forth, and the European negotiations are a spin-off, in a sense, from the United Nations negotiations. There's another point about the Universal Declaration, which has been argued very much by Mary Ann Glendon in a very highly readable book on the subject. She makes the case for saying that the Universal Declaration was the product of not just Western European and American culture, but was a multicultural document. And she goes into some detail into who the people were who were involved in the negotiations. I think she slightly overplays that, but it is true that, for example, one of the leading people behind that was a guy called Malik, who was a Lebanese, Arab-Lebanese Christian. So he was, he wasn't, from Western Europe. On the other hand, he taught at Harvard and so on, been a pupil in Germany. So I don't know what you say about that. But there was a very distinguished Chinese philosopher involved in the negotiations. There were other people. So there was a sort of multicultural air about the Universal Declaration. There certainly wasn't a multicultural air about the European Convention. The European Convention is solidly Western European. I mean, there's no doubt about that at all.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Some of the themes that we focus on this term at the Center for the Study of Human Rights have been picked up by the audience. And for example, next week, we do focus on this issue of poverty and the human rights and the poor. And here is a big conference we're co-hosting on Wednesday. But on Tuesday, the 21st of October, we have Mary Robinson coming here to give a talk, a lunchtime talk, and she'll be addressing issues related to UNICEF and poverty generally. And we have a very big conference scheduled, all-day conference on asylum. Humans Without Rights is our rather provocative question mark title. I don't know if there is a question mark, actually. And that's here on the 1st of November, which is a Saturday, an all-day conference here. We have to charge some nominal sum. And I have to say that the tickets are going fast. And if you were interested in coming, it might be worthwhile booking that through us quite soon. And on the 10th of December, Human Rights Day, we have Irene Khan, who runs Amnesty, who will be talking about the role of Amnesty in really the promotion of human rights. So quite a lot of the themes that have been picked up both in Brian's talk and afterwards will be developed in further talks this term. There's other things going on as well. They're on the website. The drinks, the location of which I have not revealed, I have enough experience to know that that means there's a sudden departure from the hall, no disrespect, of course, to the questioners and the answering. The drinks will be in the Robinson Room, which I'm told is on the third floor, and Brian's coming up there, and we can continue our conversations. But let me just say on behalf of you all how grateful I am and we are for such a tremendous tour of the background to and the politics of and the law relating to the European Convention on Human Rights. And we're very grateful to you for having come and put such work into preparing and doing the talk so well. Brian, thank you very much.